All right, so let's dive into a situation where legal ethics and contract law, well, they kind of like go head to head. You know what I mean? We're unpacking the case of Danzig v. Danzig from Washington State. And trust me, this one, it gets interesting.
Yeah, this case, it really shows you the tension that can come up, I guess, when you have a contract that might go against those rules of professional conduct for attorneys.
Okay, so let's set the scene here. We've got Steven Danzig. And he says he had this referral agreement with an attorney, Jeffrey Danzig. So Steven's supposed to bring in clients, and then Jeffrey pays him like a percentage of the attorney's fees. Makes sense.
Initially it does, but the agreement supposedly involved this thing called running and capping.
Running and capping. What is that? Sounds like something you do in gym class.
Okay, so think of it this way. Instead of a lawyer getting clients like through their reputation or advertising or whatever, they're paying someone to basically round up clients for them. And in Washington, that's a big no-no. It's unethical and it's actually illegal.
Gotcha. So Steven brings in these clients. Jeffrey supposedly stops paying him his cut. And we're talking about almost $89,000 in unpaid referral fees. That's not nothing. What happened when this went to court?
Well, the trial court's response was kind of a mixed bag. They dismissed Steven's contract claim, saying the whole agreement was illegal. But here's the thing. They also told Jeffrey to pay that $89,000 to the court while they looked into whether he earned those fees the right way.
Hold on, wait a minute. How can they say the contract is illegal, but Jeffrey still has to pay? Something doesn't add up there.
You're getting at exactly what the appellate court addressed later. It's like saying you can't sell stolen goods, but the thief still gets to keep all the money. It just doesn't make sense.
So how did the appellate court fix this legal mess?
They focused on two things. First, they looked at whether the trial court was right to dismiss Stephen's claim based on a motion to dismiss, which basically is just checking if a complaint like holds any legal weight.
So they were deciding if Steven's complaint even had a chance.
And this is where it gets interesting. The appellate court was like, hold on. Even if we say the contract's illegal, we can't automatically say that Steven's equally guilty. And they brought up this legal idea of in peri delicto.
In peri delicto, remind me what that is.
It basically means in equal fault. The court said those rules against running and capping are mostly aimed at attorneys, not the person referring the clients. So Steven might be less at fault than Jeffrey, especially if he didn't know he was doing something wrong.
So they're saying Steven's complaint deserves to be heard in court because he might be able to prove he wasn't as involved in the wrongdoing.
That's it. They weren't saying the contract was valid, just that Steven's complaint wasn't completely baseless, needed more consideration. Ready for the second issue the appellate court dealt with?
Lay it on me.
This one's all about jurisdiction. Who has the power to do what in our legal system? The appellate court said the trial court went too far by ordering Jeffrey to pay that $89,000 to the court for disciplinary reasons.
I don't get it. Why was that a problem?
Because in Washington state, attorney discipline is the responsibility of the Supreme Court, not the trial court. The trial court was trying to punish Jeffrey for maybe doing something wrong, and they just don't have that authority.
So the trial court was trying to be judge, jury, and executioner all at once. I see why the appellate court stopped that.
Exactly. The appellate court drew a line in the sand. Trial courts, they can order fees returned in certain cases, but they can't punish for past actions that might be ethically iffy. That's the Supreme Court's job.
Okay, now I'm seeing how this case is less about the contract and more about who can do what in the legal system.
You got it. And that takes us straight to the heart of the argument between the majority and the dissenting opinions in this case.
Ooh, a dissent. Now this is getting good. Tell me more.
Well, the majority basically said that refusing to enforce this contract wouldn't really help the public because the legal services had already been provided. The fees were earned, even if how they were earned was a little sus.
So the majority is being practical.
Yeah.
Work was done, money changed hands. Let's not sweat the details too much.
You could see it that way. But the dissenting judges, they were worried about setting a bad precedent.
What do you mean?
They were concerned that if someone like Steven could sue for his part of the money, even though the whole thing was questionable, it would basically be rewarding bad behavior, like saying, hey, it's okay to break the rules if you make money doing it.
I get it. So the dissent is more idealistic, putting the integrity of the legal profession first, no matter what. It's like a battle between practicality and principle.
Exactly. And that clash makes us ask a big question. Is this case really about fairness to Steven? Or is it more about keeping those ethical standards in the legal world, even if someone loses out financially?
That's a tough one. It's like having to choose between two things that are both important. And I have a feeling this is where things get even more complicated in the next part of our deep dive.
Oh, yeah. You're in for a ride. We've got more legal twists and turns to explore, so stay tuned. This case, it really shows you how hard it is to be fair to people while still, like, upholding the integrity of the legal profession as a whole.
Yeah, it's a real balancing act. You can't go too far one way or the other.
Exactly. And it's even trickier here. Because the appellate court didn't actually say the contract was valid. They just said it wasn't so obviously illegal that it should be dismissed right away.
So it's not about whether the contract was good or bad. It's about whether Stephen had the right to even bring his case to court.
Right. The appellate court was saying a motion to dismiss isn't a trial. It's more like a first check.
So it's a first hurdle to clear before the real race even starts.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. They basically said that Stephen's complaint cleared that first hurdle and it needed to be looked at more closely.
Okay, and going back to that $89,000 Jeffrey had to pay to the court.
Yeah.
That part always felt weird to me. It was like the trial court was trying to punish Jeffrey, even though they dismissed Stephen's claim.
And that's why the appellate court reversed that order. They said really clearly that trial courts can't go around disciplining attorneys for past conduct. That's the Washington Supreme Court's job.
So even if the trial court thought something shady was going on, they couldn't do anything about it themselves.
Nope. They had to stick to the specific case in front of them. They could order fees returned if it was part of that case. But they couldn't punish Jeffrey for things that might have happened before.
So it's all about respecting the limits of each court's power.
Absolutely. It's a really important point for both lawyers and judges. You gotta stay in your lane. Or things can get really messy, legally speaking.
This case is full of lessons. It's like a crash course in how contract law, ethics, and court procedures all work together.
Couldn't agree more. And just when you think you've got it all figured out, Danzig v. Danzig throws you another curveball.
There's more. I'm listening. What else can we learn from this case?
It shows us this interesting detail about the in pari delicto doctrine. Remember, that's the one about both parties being equally at fault?
Yeah, like you can't complain if you were just as involved in the wrongdoing.
Exactly. But Danzig v. Danzig shows that courts are willing to be more flexible with this idea, especially when it's someone who's not a lawyer. They might not know all the rules.
So in this case, Stephen, as a non-lawyer, might get a bit more leeway. Because he might not have known that running and capping was forbidden.
That's the idea. The court recognized that Stephen wasn't playing by the same rules as Jeffrey, who as an attorney should have known better.
It's like expecting someone who's never played chess to know all the rules. You can't hold him to the same standard as a grandmaster.
Perfect analogy.
Huh.
And that detail is important. Because it means that even if a contract's technically illegal, the person who's less at fault might still have some legal options.
So it's not always black and white. There's some gray area.
Yeah.
Especially when someone might have been taken advantage of or just didn't understand the rules of the game.
You got it. Recognizing those power imbalances adds another layer of complexity to this case.
I can see why lawyers would be debating this case for years.
Yeah.
It brings up so many big questions about fairness, accountability, and the balance between protecting people and keeping those professional standards high.
Absolutely. Danzig v. Danzig is like a puzzle box with so many layers to it.
We've definitely peeled back some of those layers.
Ugh.
But I think there's still more to find in the last part of our deep dive.
You're right. We've got some loose ends to tie up and some things to think about.
Can't wait. Let's finish this legal roller coaster ride. Okay, so we've gone through this whole Danzig v. Danzig thing, where contract law and ethics kind of crash into each other.
Mm-hmm.
What's the takeaway here? Like, what can we as non-lawyers learn from all this?
I think it shows how important it is that attorney discipline is handled by the Supreme Court. You know, it's a specialized thing for a reason.
Yeah, why is that so important?
Well, it makes sure there's a consistent and fair way to deal with ethical violations. Imagine if every trial court could just decide on its own penalties for misconduct. It'd be chaos. Total mess.
So it keeps things fair. Mm. Make sure all attorneys are held to the same standard.
Exactly. The Supreme Court is like a safeguard, protecting the public and keeping the legal profession in check.
That makes sense. But what about Stephen? Does he just get nothing because the contract was illegal?
Not necessarily. Remember, the appellate court didn't say it was a good contract, but they said Stephen deserved his chance in court. He might still get some fees, especially if he can show he's less at fault than Jeffrey.
So there's still hope for him to get something.
Definitely. And that's where in pari delicto comes in again. The court realized that Stephen, as a non-lawyer, might not have understood the ethical side of running and capping. He might have had a totally different idea of what was going on.
Right. It's like accidentally walking into a private club without knowing you need a membership. You didn't mean to break the rules. You just didn't know them.
Exactly. And that can make a big difference when courts are trying to figure out who's to blame. They don't want to punish someone who genuinely didn't know any better.
Well, that's good to hear. It seems like the law isn't always so strict and unforgiving. There's room for some understanding, especially with these complicated ethical situations.
Yeah, you're right. And that's what makes a case like this so interesting. It makes you think about these gray areas, to find that balance between what's right in theory and what's fair in practice.
It's definitely given us a lot to think about. Any last words for our listeners as we wrap up our deep dive?
I think the main thing to remember is that even if a contract is illegal, the person who's less at fault might still be able to get something back. It all depends on how much they were involved and what they knew about the wrongdoing.
So it's a good reminder that even when things get messy legally, there's still a chance for things to work out fairly.
Exactly. And that's important for everyone, not just lawyers. Anyone who's ever signed a contract, which is pretty much all of us.
Well said. This Danzig v. Danzig case has been a fascinating look at how legal ethics and contract law can get so intertwined. It's one of those cases that leaves you with more questions than answers. It reminds us that the law is always changing, trying to find that balance between sticking to the rules and being fair.
It's been great joining you for this deep dive. Until next time, stay sharp and keep asking those questions.
And that's a wrap on our deep dive into Danzig v. Danzig. Catch us next time on The Deep Dive, where we break down the complexities of the world, one case at a time.